Hi there, I'm Mark Lundbeck. This is number 0579, the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0579. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, you'll meet former Vegas police officer turned author Mark Russin, whose upcoming book is called Metro, Sin City Chronicles.
I have different chapters, and the way that I wrote it, it was meant to be like a police ride, like you're with me in the squad car, and each chapter is a different call. So we start out with a call where I'm parked at a traffic light, and a shooting call comes out, and I end up being the first responder, and some guy is there laying in the street. Legs are still inside of his RV, but his head is completely blown off, so he's got no head left, and he's laying with his back on the pavement, bleeding out, and I'm the first responder.
Nigel Okoro, one of the stars of the upcoming film, The Black Emperor of Broadway. It's the true story of the first black star on Broadway, who, even though he was black, he still had to perform in blackface.
It was definitely a style, and it was just a style that people just fit right on in. So if you wanted to be part of this theatrical experience, you had to fall right in line. And yeah, so because it was also exaggerated with the lips, the way they did their eyes, no black person ever looked black. So in order to play a black person, you had to put on the black face because it was the theatrical experience of what it means to be black in America, which made no sense, you know, these sort of checking and diving characters who were not real people. They were caricatures.
Edward Willett is the author of the fantasy novel The Moonlit World. It's the third in a series of books.
It was always designed as a series. I wanted to come up with a concept that would allow me to write a multitude of different kinds of stories within one overarching concept. What I keep referring it back to is Doctor Who, which is the greatest storytelling conceit anybody ever came up with, because you can tell literally any kind of story in the framework of Doctor Who, historical or far future or present day or whatever you want. My concept is a bit like that, in that there's this labyrinth of shaped worlds that the shapers of them live within them, sort of like authors living inside their books.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0579, was Mark Lundbeck, the station manager at CKHR 107.3 FM in Hay River, Northwest Territories, one of the many places that plays the Stuff File Program. Thank you very much, Mark, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File Program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? A commuter boarded a bus between Swinton and Manchester, England on September 14th, sporting what one fellow passenger thought was a funky mask, until it started to move. The face mask turned out to be a live snake wrapped around the man's neck and over his nose and mouth. Another passenger took pictures and posted them on Twitter, commenting, "Each to their own and all that." "No one batted an eyelid," another rider said. Transport for Greater Manchester, however, said in a statement that snakeskin, especially when it's still attached to the snake, is not suitable for masks. And you thought inhaling your own bad breath with a mask was bad. Try inhaling snake scales all day. Okay, on this show, we've often mentioned the ridiculous lengths some people will go in letting loved ones know what gender their upcoming child will be. We've shared many of these stories on this program over the years, and you've no doubt heard that one of the biggest forest fires currently raging in California was started by a gender reveal party gone wrong. What happened to the good old days when you just simply said, hey, it's a boy, or it's a girl, or both? But no, people want to continue to show off and show up others, so let's bring you the latest victim, shall we? A Massachusetts man redefined the term blue balls during a gender reveal party gone wrong last month, and the result was a viral video viewed more than 750,000 times and left many men doubling over in sympathy pain. 43-year-old Tom Cressotti and his 36-year-old wife, Kristen, planned the party in East Longmeadow, Massachusetts, to reveal the gender of their second child, along with 4-year-old daughter Ella, in attendance for the big event on August the 30th. The couple, who had been married for 6 years, opted to use Canon cartridges filled with powder, blue for a boy and pink for a girl, to let their gathered friends and family know the gender of their child, which is due in February. But Tom was holding the cartridge the wrong way and, following the countdown by those in attendance, inadvertently blasted himself in the crotch with blue powder, sending him to the lawn while clutching his family jewels. As he doubled over, one friend yells,
"Ain't no need for a vasectomy!"
Note the sound of compassion from his less sensitive friends. According to mother-to-be Christian, we were apparently holding the powder cannons pointing in the wrong direction. When used correctly, the powder should be dispensed 20 to 30 feet in the air. Since Tom's cannon was unknowingly pointed right at his genitals, he was directly blasted. Apparently, this was all my fault. Tom, in his moment of agony, appears to agree with his wife's statement.
Gave it to me the wrong way!
Tom was unhurt during the incident, but it could have turned out much worse. The powder charge just missed hitting young Ella, who stood beside her father, in the face. I bet he'll rethink the idea of gender reveal parties in the future. Then again, he may have already solved that problem. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Las Vegas has earned its reputation as Sin City. And back in the early 1980s, when Mark Russin was a young officer there, his job brought him face to face with some crazy situations. Mark is also a former ATF special agent, and he's been a consultant on CSI and other shows. He's the author of the upcoming book, Metro, Sin City Chronicles, and an earlier novel, Justice for Dallas. Mark joins us on the line from Tucson, Arizona. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Peter. How you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. So you were working in Vegas as a young police officer. In many people's minds, that's like being a sheriff in the Wild Wild West. Or is that an exaggeration?
I think that's kind of an exaggeration. Back in the early 80s, Las Vegas was incorporated their police department back then. It's since 1973 to Metro. So we had the flare of the city lights and Sin City, as well as the backdrop and the whole county of Clark County, which is what we patrolled at like 8,000 square miles. So I think that might be a little bit off, but it's more was like a city life deal, and especially with all the tourists that we dealt with on a yearly basis. So,
well, I was going to ask about the tourists because, you know, that old phrase that you always hear, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, and people go there with that mindset. As a police officer working in that city, did you have more situations involving tourists as opposed to natives who live in Vegas year-round?
Well, that's a good question. It depended on actually our beat for the evening. We worked the Strip. I worked the Strip most of my career there for 4 years, and the surrounding area. So in the surrounding areas, you know, just off the Strip, you had people that worked on the Strip that lived there. There was a large concentration of working girls and pimps and hookers and stuff like that. There was a lot of crime in the area. Obviously, where the money is, the criminals go. A lot of tourists that we had to deal with break-ins and what we call trick rolls and robberies and stuff like that on the strip, a lot of suicides, a lot of shootings, that type of thing.
Now, the book I mentioned, Metro, Sin City Chronicles, it's not out yet. It's coming out in probably the beginning of next year. Is that correct?
Yeah, the manuscript's done. I'm shooting for to come out next year.
Okay, so
early next year, that'd be great.
Give us a taste of some of the things that you will talk about in your book, Metro, Sin City Chronicles.
I have different chapters, and the way that I wrote it, it was meant to be like a police ride. Okay, like you're with me in the squad car, and each chapter is actually a different call. So we start out with a call where I'm parked at a traffic light and a shooting call comes out and I end up being the first responder. And some guy is there laying in the street, legs are still inside of his RV, but his head is completely blown off. So he's got no head left and he's laying with his back on the pavement, bleeding out. And I'm the first responder. I get there and then there's a crowd of people and I have to figure out what I have to do to try and get this situation under control. So that's kind of one of them that I talk about. There's another one where I deal with the Vegas nightlife. I deal with talking about tourists, different things like trick rolls and what the working girls or the prostitutes do to these guys when they rip them off and they set them up and they drug them or they try and get them full of drinks. Then they steal all their money and their jewelry and their watches. And these guys don't know what's going on, that type of thing. I talk about the time I hit a kid in a crosswalk going to a hot call where I ended up actually hitting a kid, breaking his leg with my squad car, and then going to visit him in the hospital because I felt so bad about what I did. I deal with the night I almost got shot after we were chasing a guy who had already shot somebody and dropped him out of a car, and how I almost died when three shots were fired at me that just landed above my head against the stucco wall that the stucco came down raining on me, and my partners returned fire shooting the guy 8 times and the guy lived. Talk about a guy who was hanging from a tree and another accident where a guy claimed it was an accident where he had a knife sticking out of his chest when I came to his door, and I didn't even see the knife sticking out of his chest. The handle of the knife was right impaled in the guy's middle of his chest, and he claimed he fell over a table when he was peeling an apple, and I found out that was a bunch of crap. And the chapter is named Accident My Ass, so he ended up confiding in me and telling me exactly, you know, what happened. I have another chapter it's called the Peppermill Pinch, which I was called to a disturbance where I ended up figuring out that a guy had left Miami and he was wanted for murder. He killed his girlfriend there, and I ended up, because he was drinking a 35-cent cup of coffee, he only had 18 cents in his pocket. I booked him on a 17 cents. This defrauding an innkeeper charge, which was crazy, but I had a feeling that he was wanted for this crime, and sure enough, he was, and he was extradited back to Miami, where he was sentenced to 25 years for killing his girlfriend, stabbing her, and choking her with a lamp cord.
Wow.
So those are some of the stories, you know, and then another one where I was really fortunate where I missed a gun on a guy that had it behind his belt buckle, a little two-shot Derringer. After he stabbed somebody and I chased him and caught him and was bringing him to lockup, and I put my gun up and I thought I had searched him well, but it was a mistake I made. And he had a little two-shot Derringer behind his belt buckle. He had one of those like Out West belt buckles, an oversized buckle. And I just failed to look behind it. It was my mistake. And when he went to the booking counter, he pulled the gun out and put it on the table. And I kind of put my hand over it to instinctively recover my fumble. And my knees buckled. And I was like, you know, Jesus Christ, this guy could have killed me because I had already put my gun up. And I ended up taking him out and asking him why he didn't kill me. And basically he said, because I was a nice guy.
Wow.
So, you know, the moral to that story is you treat your arrestees with respect because you never know when you make a mistake, you know, because they could easily blow your head off.
Speaking of blowing one's head off, you mentioned a story, first of all, where you saw this guy with his head blown off then when you were the first responder to the call. Do you have to, or have you ever dealt with post-traumatic stress after seeing some of the things you've seen?
You know, that's a good question. When I was involved in that shooting I told you about, I actually, it was a weird deal because I was actually placed in harm's way. I was in a courtyard of apartment complexes where this guy had just shot at another officer. And not only had he shot a guy in the street, then he shot at the officer who was chasing him. And then we came in to surround him, and the dogs were coming in, and the helicopter was above. And he was in a bush, but I didn't know where. It was pitch black. It was 2 a.m, and I didn't know where he was. But when he popped out, and all I saw out of the corner of my eye was the muzzle flash, I kind of recoiled away from the shots when the bullets were actually going above my head. And I was more upset that I couldn't return fire because I just couldn't get my body to turn that quickly. And my partners all returned fire. Like I said, he was shot 8 times and he still lived. And after that scene, you know, I didn't want my partners to think I was a coward because I was the only guy that didn't shoot. And I just physically couldn't turn my body to get engaged in the target like we're trained, because my physiological reflex was turning away from the danger, from the muzzle flash, you know, the gunfire. So I talked to a guy who they had in Las Vegas that was, you know, pretty much a psychiatrist, and he explained to me exactly what I went through and that it was normal that your body would react in that way, and anybody else that was in the line of fire like that would have reacted the same way. So it made me feel a little bit better. And then I went back to the scene where I saw where the bullets had hit the stucco wall, and I tried to stoop down as low as I could, and I couldn't get down, crunched down far enough with my body like the next day. And I asked him about that, and he said, that's because when you're in fear of your life like that, he said, your body does unbelievable things, and your body could actually get down smaller. And thank God that's the way it was, because I mean, the bullets would have hit me right in the head if I had been up another, you know, 3 to 6 inches.
Wow.
So those were a couple things that were you know, hairy situations for me. And I only had one other time where, you know, a guy actually pulled a gun on me, and I was able to talk him into not pointing it at me, and before I ended up shooting him. But I had him covered, and I was begging him to drop the gun, screaming top of my lungs. And finally he acquiesced, and he did. And I was able to tackle him and get the gun from him and take him in to lock him up. So.
Well,
two of the hairiest situations.
We've got just about a minute, but I got to ask you this. I mentioned in the introduction, you've also been a consultant on shows like CSI. So I've got to ask, when you're watching police dramas on TV, what's the thing that that happens in a police television show that you hate the most, that doesn't represent as at best what you as police officers do?
Well, two things. First of all, the crime never gets solved in an hour. That's for one thing. The other thing is, you know, the trauma that is involved in shooting. They glorify like shootings, like, you know, like on Miami Vice or something like that, where guys shoot and they still go out to go to work and blah, blah, blah. You know, it doesn't happen like that. I mean, shootings are traumatic in, you know, situations. I mean, police officers are automatically taken off duty. They're put on administrative leave. There's a coroner's inquest if it resulted in a death, or there's a shooting investigation, a very serious one that's put on. And, you know, the officers are now, in today's, it's a little bit different because you automatically go to a psychiatrist now, I understand, with, you know, when you're involved in a situation like that, whereas before it was, you know, up to the shooter. And most of the guys have that macho attitude, and they don't want to, you know, they don't want to be looked upon as being weak or something like that back in the old days. And because the big thing was not to be sent to the rubber gun squad where you ended up, you know, pushing paper or something like that, taken off the street. Mm. So, but nowadays it's pretty much common practice that, you know, your gun goes off, your gun is taken from you. It's taken to ballistics. It's investigated. The whole situation's investigated. And Now they have body cams and everything, for the most part. So, and trust me, I am so lucky that I never had to shoot my weapon in 28 years of law enforcement. You know, I was a cop for 4, street cop, and then I was a federal agent for 24. And I thank the Lord I never had to, I had to pull my gun several times, obviously, but I never had to fire it. And, the bottom line is that is what every officer hopes. He never has to use his weapon. So
your upcoming book is called Metro Sin City Chronicles. Your previous book, which is a novel, which is out, which is called Justice for Dallas. Mark, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for calling.
Mark Russin, author of the upcoming book, Metro, Sin City Chronicles. His previous book that has been out for a few years is a novel called Justice for Dallas, which is the story of a quadruple homicide case he worked on when he was an ATF agent. He's currently working with Hollywood to try and turn that into a movie. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0579, and you'll find links to Mark's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his first book, Justice for Dallas, directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at Patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, coming to you from Montreal, Canada, where we share the longest unprotected border in the world with the United States. Take that as a sign of extreme friendship or a warning.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to one of the stars of the movie The Black Emperor of Broadway. Plus, we'll meet the author of The Moonlit World. It's part of a series of books. This is the third one in that series of fantasy novels. We have an idiot of the day coming your way and much more Stuff File news here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, just to name a few. You can find buttons for Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or iHeartRadio right on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, let's get back to the stuff, shall we? It seems with great regularity that we often have stories of what people do when they're on meth. So let's check in with the latest installment of This Week on Meth. A New Hampshire man who was seen doing jumping jacks in his neighbor's driveway and sniffing a shrub has been arrested on methamphetamine charges. Officers responding to a report of a shirtless man with no shoes doing jumping jacks in the driveway of a home in Merrimack found 36-year-old James Albert sniffing a shrub with his eyes closed. While speaking with Albert, an officer noted more behaviors consistent with drug use. Albert was then found to be in possession of a bag containing a crystal substance, which he allegedly admitted was methamphetamine. Meanwhile, Mark King of Walcottville, Indiana, went to war with imaginary enemies after using meth on the previous 2 days. Deputies from the LaGrange County Sheriff's Department responding to reports of a man swinging a broom handle around and hollering in a yard found King as he left a neighbor's garage after having thrown a gun through the building's window. Previously, police determined King had allegedly shot up the inside of his own home, imagining that people were trying to break in and steal some of his belongings. He was transported to a hospital and later charged with possession of meth and paraphernalia. Why do I get the feeling that being on meth is like being trapped in a Christopher Nolan film script where all you get to do is stare at and argue with Jackson Pollock paintings? Yeah. A Taco Bell in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, called police when a man drove up to the drive-thru window to get his order and was clearly not wearing any clothes. After getting his food, he ordered another taco and waited at the window. Then he asked for more sauce, then extra napkins. After leaving, he swung through again, asking for still more sauce. When officers arrived, they asked 61-year-old Christopher Sale what he was doing there. He was hungry, he said. Why no clothes? They're all in the wash, he said. He was arrested, charged with indecent exposure, and booked into jail. Wow. You'd think, he being so heavily sauced, that they could arrest him for DUI.
Yo quiero Taco Bell.
Yo quiero indeed. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, an Alaskan dentist known for running afoul of the law has been sentenced to 12 years in jail for various misdemeanors that include extracting a patient's tooth while riding on a hoverboard. Seth Lookhart was sentenced in Anchorage Superior Court on dozens of charges stemming from actions that range from his scooting antics to Medicaid fraud and removing a patient's teeth without their permission. Back in January, he was convicted on charges of reckless endangerment, illegally practicing dentistry, and medical assistance fraud. Said Judge Michael Wolverton, as he handed down the sentence, "In reviewing all this over and over again, I have this visceral response. You darn near kill some people." The court heard testimony from patient Veronica Wilhelm, who was sedated when Lookhart was recorded performing her tooth extraction on a hoverboard in July of 2016. On the cell phone video, Lookhart could be seen riding away from the procedure with his hands triumphantly in the air. He allegedly texted a video of the stunt to at least 8 people, joking that this was a new standard of care. Lookhart, who had his dental license suspended in 2017, was also ordered by the judge not to practice medicine during his 10-year probation once he's released from prison. Oh, that must leave him down in the mouth. You know, it could have been worse for his patients. They could have had Sir Laurence Olivier from Marathon Man as their dentist.
Is it safe? Look, I tell you, I can't do that.
Yes, since I played that clip from Marathon Man with Sir Laurence Olivier and Dustin Hoffman, I have to pause for a moment to share a legendary film story. You may have heard it. As most of you know, Olivier was a classically trained actor, and Hoffman was a method actor. On the set, Olivier asked Hoffman, "How did your week go, dear boy?" Hoffman told him that he had filmed a scene in which his character was supposed to have been up for 3 days straight. "So what did you do?" Olivier asked. Hoffman replied, "Well, I stayed up for 3 days and 3 nights." Olivier then uttered the now famous line, "Why don't you just try acting, dear boy?" That story is deliciously legendary. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program. Nigah Okoro is one of the stars of the film The Black Emperor of Broadway. It's the true story of the first African-American leading man on Broadway, Charles Gilpin. Nigah plays Charles's wife, Florence, and she joins us on the line from Los Angeles. Hi, Nigah.
Hi, it's so good to talk to you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Now, I feel almost embarrassed at the fact that this is such a prominent story that I knew nothing about.
Okay, now if you're embarrassed, how about an African-American woman who went to Juilliard and studied drama and also went to the performing arts high school, LaGuardia, the fame school, and still didn't know. You know what I mean? I'm mortified. I was mortified. It's part of why I really wanted to do this project. And I was so excited to get to be a part of it because it's embarrassing that, you know, to not know of this man.
Okay, so
but that has to change.
So with your background, as you said, from what was your first reaction when this script came your way or the possibility of being in this movie came your way? What was your very first reaction about this character?
Charles Gilpin?
Yes.
Yeah, my first reaction was I was embarrassed, truly. Like, I mean, you know, I do my best to try to educate myself because, you know, schools, a lot of schools didn't, I'm not speaking Julia, I'm talking about New York City public high school, public schools, but I do my best to try to at least familiarize myself with, you know, theater history and, you know, Black history. And I was mortified. I was embarrassed. And he actually is buried in the Bronx. I'm from the Bronx. And he was originally buried in an unmarked grave because he died, penniless. I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed, but then very curious and excited when I found out that I could be a part of this because I started to learn that most people don't know about him.
Now, the thing I found most baffling is, okay, I'm familiar with the concept of blackface and its mm-hmm. place in history, but the idea that someone would want to make a Black man wear blackface?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah.
It's fascinating. I mean, it was a style. It was definitely a style, and it was just a style that people just fit right on in. So if you wanted to be part of this sort of theatrical experience, you had to fall right in line. And yeah, so because it was also exaggerated with the lips and the way they did their eyes and, you know, and no Black person ever looked like that. So in order to play a Black person, you had to put on the black face because it was the theatrical experience of what it means to be Black in America, like, which made no sense, you know, these sort of like shucking and jiving characters who were not real people. They were caricatures. So they were basically cartooning themselves for work. I mean, and work is a valid thing, you know. And as artists, we do or confront where we're like, I don't, you know, you question it and go, is this okay? Like, should I be doing this? But I need to work, you know? So you constantly go up against these moral dilemmas. I can't even imagine if blackface was a thing right now. You know what I mean? Like, what kind of conversations we'd be having as artists?
Wow. Now, going back into this period of time, I understand Charles Gilpin was cast by playwright Eugene O'Neill to be the lead in his play, The Emperor Jones. Now, this was back in 1920. Is Eugene O'Neill a hero for hiring, or is he a villain for, again, wanting him to mm-hmm. wanting a Black man to be in blackface? Where does Eugene O'Neill come up in this, as far as on which side he's on?
Yeah, this is interesting. I love this question. I think it's complicated. I think there is a heroism in it because he decided to make a Black man a star of his story. But I also think he was of the time. And so, you know, while it's almost like, you know, nowadays there are like white folks who are like, you know, no, I'm liberal. You know what I mean? I'm liberal. And, you know, I care about Black people and I have Black friends. And then, you know, because of the times we're in, they might say something and they don't realize it's inappropriate or racist or, you know, or whatever. And they realize, oh, gosh, I'm just one of them. And it's not that. It's just this is the time we're in, you know, and I think Eugene O'Neill was a product of his time. He was ahead of his time, but he also was still a product of his time. So it's complicated and it's really human.
Mm. So tell us about your role as Charles's wife, Florence.
So there isn't much noted about her. There's not much I could find on her except that they were married and had a child. I found it interesting. Once I got over the fact that I couldn't find out much about her, I just found it interesting that this woman who, you know, of this period, you know, in the 1920s, to be a Black woman and have a Black husband who decides he wants to be an actor, you know, and what kind of a woman stays and supports that. Like, in my mind, she supports, like, you know, once she had to get over, okay, what is this thing? I believe she supported him. And I just thought that that was heroic in its own right, you know, because, like, you know, these days, I mean, you know, there are people who are just now getting on board with my career. You know what I mean? Like, I've had family members who were like, what are you doing? Like, you really are moving to California? Like, and, you know, you're pursuing an acting, you know? So I'm just imagining a woman in the 20s and needing, you, like, not pushing him to be a porter or, you know, a bellhop or, you know. So I just created her based on that, you know. Like, I think that there's a strength to that. There's a you know, some sort of faith, some sort of belief, some love, you know. So I just thought of her as almost walking love.
What was it like on the set? And the reason why I asked that is because we're talking about a story that goes back to a time when, let's be honest, blacks weren't necessarily treated as the way they should have been. And you're working with actors who might feel some, white guilt in the role they have to play. So what was the set like?
Oh, that's a great question too. Gosh, you got good ones. So the set was very curious, meaning people were very curious about their roles and their work, and very loving. Like Nick Moran, who is in the film, he was like, I mean, he was like Papa Bear in terms of, like, he was cooking for everyone and hosting gatherings and scouting locations when, you know, times got kind of hard on set in terms of finding stuff. So it was a very supportive environment. I do remember one incident where one of the, I can't remember the lady's name, but one of the people in our film, she had to wear blackface, and she's a white woman. And, you know, I think she literally didn't think about it, but she was sort of outside smoking cigarettes, you know, like taking her breaks, just kind of hanging out outside with this blackface on. And I just remember being mortified, but it also helped me to drop into the time period, because this would have been normal, you know, and it would have been normalized. And I don't think she realized, though, like, you know, the weight of it. You know, I think she was, you know, just working and, you know, and then kind of, you know, taking her break as she should take her break. But did not think about, I'm walking around the streets in blackface with my hair done like a pickaninny kind of character, you know? And so, you know, there's always going to be sensitivities, you know? And I think that's part of what is happening now collectively in our society. And I think it'll help us to grow when we can just have these conversations, you know, and be uncomfortable and be in tight spaces. So for the most part, it was totally like, you know, roses in terms of, you know, everyone just being curious about each other and willing to share stories. But yeah, you know, it definitely, these topics come up, you know, they come up and they come up in different ways. So yeah. Yeah, well, it was a wonderful set.
Well, to be fair to that actress, I'm sure it was one of those situations, like any actor, you put on the wardrobe, you put on the makeup, and you kind of forget you're wearing it.
Yes.
Unless you look in a mirror.
No, listen, absolutely. I don't think she meant, there was nothing in, like, she was literally doing what an actor does. You know what I mean? So she's playing a monster, let's say, you know what I mean? She's going to go outside, have a break, have a little, you know, chat on the phone and take her smoke break. But it was walking up on that and going, oh, wow. And I think because what goes on in the film resonates with today so viscerally that I think that's also part of why it had such an effect on me and other people that saw her. You know what I mean? Like, if this was a time of yesteryear where this doesn't apply anymore, you know, this is this like staid sort of period piece, you know, in a glass, you know, and you're like, oh, what did those people do back then? You know, then it might be something different. But I think all of the topics that are brought up in this film, I mean, are like, you could just drop them today. Like, it's just, it's sadly relevant.
Well, it's a fascinating story. The movie is called The Black Emperor of Broadway. Nigel, thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Oh, thank you for having me. This has been my pleasure. It was so good talking to you.
And it was great talking to you, too. That's Nigel Okoro, one of the stars of the film The Black Emperor of Broadway. The movie is available on video on demand and will be out on DVD on October the 6th. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com and check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0579, and you'll find links to Nigel's website, the website for the film, plus links to see the trailer as well. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. This broadcast is coming to you from upstairs. Get out of the house.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of The Moonlit World. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way. But I got one more Stuff File news story to share with you here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio, and Spotify, and iHeartRadio, just to name a few. So, if you're doing quite well selling fake merchandise on Facebook, what's the next logical step in your life? Why, opening up a store, of course. In South Carolina, Mark Harmon, the Secretary of State there, announced the seizure of over $300,000 in counterfeit merchandise from a business. The seizure came after a 6-month investigation into New Image SC, the store's operator, Quashita Parker, sold shoes, clothing, sunglasses, jewelry, perfumes and colognes, watches, hats, and face masks falsely branded as Louis Vuitton, Pink, Versace, Chanel, Burberry, Gucci, Fendi, Cartier, Nike, Champion, NFL, NBA, and NCAA. The business originated on Facebook, but eventually grew to include sales at a storefront. Authorities raided the store and Parker's residence and discovered $316,315 worth of counterfeit merchandise all over the place. You have to be either dumb or bold or both to open up a store to sell fake goods. I mean, you have to know that at some point your time will run out, even on a fake Rolex. Anyway, let's get to our last guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Edward Willett has just released the third book in his World Shapers fantasy series. This one is called The Moonlit World. It follows World Shaper and Master of the World. Edward is also the editor of an anthology featuring stories by international best-selling and award-winning authors of science fiction and fantasy called Shapers of Worlds. He joins us via Skype from Regina, Saskatchewan. Hi, Edward.
Hi, Peter.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So we'll start off with your book. Again, the third in a series. Is it the third in a trilogy, or is there still more to come?
It's an open-ended series. Whether there's more to come will ultimately depend on, you know, sales and all that. But this does not wrap it up. So yes, there's more to come.
When you first started writing this, did you anticipate that it was going to be something that was going to be a series of books?
It was always designed as a series. I wanted to come up with a concept that would allow me to write a multitude of different kinds of stories within one overarching concept. What I keep referring it back to is Doctor Who, which is the greatest storytelling conceit anybody ever came up with, because you can tell literally any kind of story in the framework of Doctor Who, historical or far future or present day or whatever you want. And my concept is a bit like that, in that there's this labyrinth of shaped worlds that the shapers of them live within them, sort of like authors living inside their books. And so as my main character, who has to flee her world and is supposed to travel to these other worlds and gather the knowledge of them to protect them all by taking that knowledge to the mysterious Agrair, who's at the center of this labyrinth, she will travel to all these different worlds, and they can literally be anything that somebody decided to make up. So the first one, World Shaper, is in a world very much like ours, and Master of the World was in a world that was shaped by somebody who really loves Jules Verne, so it's all airships and submarines and floating islands and weird weapons and all of that. And then the Moonlit World is werewolves and vampires. So it's really an open-ended concept that I could literally write any story I wanted to within this framework. I could set one in a My Little Pony world if I wanted to, but I probably won't.
Well, that's an interesting concept, because as a writer and also someone who works as an editor, you are used to dealing with and creating certain boundaries with where your story is created within. But it sounds like you have a situation here where you don't have any normal boundaries. So do you have to kind of self-police as a writer?
Well, I'm looking for stories that, like I said, I probably would not write one set in a My Little Pony world, although the concept would allow for it. Once my character is inside that particular world that the story is set in, then it is constrained like any other novel set within a made-up world. So she has to deal with whatever that particular shaped world is. But I try to find the things that I really wanted to set stories in, because ultimately I am the only one that decides. And if there is a fourth book and it's all planned out, it's set in a film noir world. So it'll be like gangsters and all that kind of stuff. So, I pick the stuff that I want to write, and I will avoid the stuff that I think wouldn't work.
Even though it is a series of books, is it something that requires you to read from the beginning, or is one entertained by jumping in, say, for instance, the third book, if they wanted to?
I think you can jump into the third book quite well. I try to make sure that all the important information is presented in each book, so that somebody can come into it cold without having read the previous two books. And hopefully if they read the third book first, they go back and read the first two books. But I do try to put in enough information so that you'll have some idea of what's going on, even if you haven't read the previous books in the series.
So tell us a little bit about the third book, The Moonlit World.
Well, as I said, it's werewolves and vampires, or as I sometimes, taking a page from The Wizard of Oz, I think of it as werewolves and vampires and peasants. Oh, my. My main character shows up. It's a world where the moon is always shining. It never moves from it's always full, and it's always in the same place in the sky. And she and her companion, Carl Yatzer, who's sort of the one who kind of knows what's going on and has been the one who's sort of been her guide, but he hasn't been to all the worlds. He doesn't know what they're going to encounter until they get into each world. They have to find the shaper of this world, and there turns out that there's warring kingdoms of vampires and werewolves, and there are humans that are kind of caught in the middle, and it wasn't supposed to be like this. Everybody's supposed to be living in peace and harmony, but they're not. So my two characters have to navigate the world of werewolves and the world of vampires and the world of peasants, and they have to somehow find out who's responsible for this mess, and then gather the knowledge of the world so they can take it on to the next world. And they have to survive while they're doing all that.
Where was the impetus for these stories? Were you somebody who was always interested into science fiction and fantasy?
Oh, yeah. I had two older brothers, both of whom read the stuff. So that's what was around the house. And so I started reading it very early. I wrote my first short story, my first complete short story, when I was 11 years old, and it was called Castor Glass Hypership Test Pilot. So you can pretty much tell how early my course was set when it came to writing. I was a huge fan, a huge reader of science fiction and fantasy growing up, and started writing very early in high school. I was writing novels in high school. And yeah, it's just been always the thing that when I come up with story ideas, there's inevitably going to be some kind of fantastical element in them. That's just the way my mind works. It's kind of like a muscle you exercise over time, and you know, you get that, it just becomes second nature.
As a critically acclaimed writer and a successful author yourself, have you had a chance to go back and look at that 11-year-old story and with a more critical eye?
I can't find it. I know I have a copy somewhere. I haven't been able to find it. If I ever find it, it's going online minutes later, because I'm not shy about sharing my early writing, because one of the things I do is a lot of teaching writing. I've been a writer in residence at the Regina and Saskatoon public libraries, and I've taught classes, and I think it's helpful for people to see that, you know, no matter how, and I'm not a particularly big name in the field, but no matter how big a name somebody becomes as a writer, we all started in the same place trying to tell stories with, you know, we all started at the very beginning. And I think it's helpful for people to see that. So if I ever find that story, I'll put it online. I have looked at some of my old novels that I wrote in high school, and I can say that they're not as bad as they might be. I think that's the way to put that.
Well, that's great. That's great. Speaking of which, it leads us to our to the other point that I wanted to talk to you about. I mentioned in the introduction, Shapers of Worlds. It's an anthology, basically, of fiction and fantasy. Tell us about that project.
Well, I have a podcast called The World Shapers, theworldshapers.com, where I interview other science fiction and fantasy writers about the creative process. And I also have a publishing company called Shadowpaw Press. I was at a Sask Books annual meeting, that's the Publishers Association here in Saskatchewan, and there was somebody who came in and talked about how they had successfully kickstarted an anthology. And I thought, hey, I know some authors. So rather arbitrarily, I reached out to everybody who was a guest on the show during the first year, it started in August 2018. And asked them if they would be interested in contributing to an anthology. And I ended up with a lot of big name authors said absolutely, they'd be happy with that, either original fiction or reprints. And then I finally got the Kickstarter together, and it worked. It funded. So I have coming out September 22nd an ebook, and in print it'll be more like mid-November. There's the Shapers of World anthology, and it has, new stories from Shauna McGuire, Tanya Huff, David Weber, Lee Modisett Jr., D.J. Butler, Christopher Rocchio, John C. Wright, Shelley Adina, and some guy named Edward Willett. Mm-hmm. And the reprints from John Scalzi, Joe Haldeman, David Brin, Julie Cerneda, Fonda Lee, Gareth L. Powell, Derek Kunskin, Dr. Charles E. Gannon, and Thurea Dyer. So among those people are many bestsellers, and some who have won, all of the major awards in the field are represented among somebody in that group of authors. So I'm very excited about that. And it's actually number one in new releases and science fiction anthologies on Amazon.com right now, I've noticed. So that bodes well for the interest in it when it comes out.
As someone who grew up as a big fan of science fiction and fantasy, and in getting some of these relatively big names to be part of your anthology, how does it feel to have the title of editor?
It was amazing. I put it in my foreword, actually. When I, you know, as a teenager reading The Forever War by Joe Haldeman, if you had told me that when I was no longer a teenager by several decades, that I would be editing an anthology that had a story by Joe Haldeman, that I would have met Joe Haldeman and his wife and had dinner with them and all that sort of thing, which has happened over the years, that I would be contracting him for a story and sending him money to put a story into an anthology I had edited, I would have thought that would never happen. And yet it's happened. And same with many of these other authors. I mean, these really are some big names from the field, and it was just a pleasure to work with them all. And I'm very excited to be able to share their work with people, both the original fiction and the reprints.
Well, we've got about a minute, so I've got to ask you, since you are, again, such a fan of all of this, what was it like? What is it like doing your podcast, which people can find at theworldshapers.com?
It is a great joy to talk to authors. I've always enjoyed talking shop with other authors, talking about the process, because we all deal with the same challenges. We're all trying to figure out how to build worlds and characterization and design plots and all that kind of stuff. And everybody has been so willing to talk to me. It doesn't matter how big they are. I can send an email, and more often than not, they'll say, sure, I'll talk to you. Or I've met some at conventions, and they'll say, Sure, I'll talk to you. And it's just been great fun for me, and I think a great resource for people who are interested in writing, because as I said, all of these writers started in the same place as anybody that wants to be a writer now, and we talk about how they got started and then how they do what they do. And I think it's of great interest both to people who want to write and also to the readers who are fans of these authors.
Sounds like a great podcast. Again, people can find it where? TheWorldShapers.com, is that right?
That is correct.
And the current book is part of a series, the third in a series. It's The Moonlit World. It's just out. It came out September 15th. And the one that's coming out on the 22nd, which is Shapers of the World, is the anthology. Have I got all the plugs in?
Yeah, Shapers of Worlds. No the in there. But
sorry,
yeah,
Shapers of Worlds. Shapers of Worlds. Edward, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. I enjoyed it.
Edward Willett, author of The Moonlit World, part of his World Shapers fantasy series. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0579, and you'll find links to his website, also his podcast site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Prosecutors said an alleged carjacker in Chicago contacted the vehicle's owner and offered to sell the 1998 Chevy Malibu back to her for $50. Assistant State's Attorney Aaron Antionetti said 24-year-old Jere Brown received a ride from the victim's car from a friend of the owner, and he forced the woman out of the driver's seat while the car was stopped. Antionetti told a hearing Brown contacted the owner of the car, a 19-year-old woman, and offered to sell it back to her for just $50. The woman arranged to meet with Brown and contacted police to accompany her to the chosen location. Police found Brown hiding in a closet in a home at the location of the arranged meeting just before 10 p.m., and he was arrested. Investigators found a key to the car inside the home where Brown was arrested, and Brown was charged with vehicular hijacking and possession of a stolen vehicle. Now, why, oh why, would you think it was a good idea to carjack a vehicle and then try to sell it back to its rightful owner without any fear of authorities being involved? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0579. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0579. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, Verdant Square Radio, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Let me leave you with these words of wisdom. Never, ever juggle ice picks while standing on your waterbed.